Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
He won Journalist of the Year from the American Conservative Union at CPAC 2015.
You like me right now. You like me.
He's National Review Online's Jim Garrity.
How do you like me now? Now that I'm on my
She's a front page contributor to Red State and a broadcast professional who calls life the way she sees it.
Yeah, crank up the radio.
Very interesting.
She's Mickey White.
How do you like me now?
This is the Jim and Mickey Show.
Welcome to the Jim and Mickey Show, brought to you by Acme Political Correctness Insurance. For all your fears of having your career destroyed by an online mob of social justice warriors. Yes, we live in an era where your entire life can be ruined over one bad joke, one misinterpreted comment, one off-the-cuff remark, or just one moment of losing your cool. That's why you need political correctness insurance. To cover the damages to your career and reputation just for running afoul of some underemployed 20-something grievance monger who declared you public enemy number one just for offending him. Or her. Or Hicks. Or whatever gender they prefer to describe themselves as. Acme Political Correctness Insurance. Let our reasonable rates give you peace of mind when the thought police are knocking at your door. I am Jim Garrity, joined by Mickey White, and welcome to a hopefully cheerier edition of the Jim and Mickey Show. Mickey, I can't think of a cheerier note to begin with than the fact that last week we talked about whether Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, could someday enter politics. And in fact, this week he declares, yes, he is thinking of, it's a real possibility, someday he could run for president.
I, I would say this to our listeners and to you and to Dave, and I'll vote for him.
There you go.
Like, I don't really need to hear his platform. I've gotten to the point now where I realize that our politics is really just the uglier version of Hollywood. And now if we're going to be bringing in more attractive people, I'm in.
Yeah. By the way, listeners should know our next segment will be about the ignorant American voter and how celebrity works.
I can't help but think, except didn't this story already play out? Didn't Arnold Schwarzenegger already do this? And we all know what happened. Still, we want to do it again. Okay.
Yeah, but Arnold wasn't born here.
That's true, but he got as high as he could get.
Rock can. And then once The Rock is president, we will officially be living in idiocracy.
Yeah, talk about the President's Council on Physical Fitness. If you can't bench 300 pounds, you lose your citizenship.
Start lifting, everybody. Now, I just want to observe, this may entirely come back to this has been murmuring and talking, and people saying, "Oh, wouldn't it be great if he ran for quite a while?" I'm going to take everyone back to August 2016. Friend of the program, Mary Catherine Hamm, said, "Hey, can we get The Rock on the debate stage? If it's going to be WrestleMania, can we get The Rock on stage so I can vote for him and be done with it?" And that was that tiny pebble that started this avalanche.
You have a pretty unbelievable memory, but considering it's MK Hamm, I understand.
Now, I understand that you actually went and saw Guardians of the Galaxy since we last talked.
I did, and it definitely lives up to the hype. I have not taken the boys to it because I know it'll go straight from the theater and the shopping mall to the Disney store to get the little I Am Groot doll.
You're one of the parents, though, that you actually do like to screen these before you take your kids. You realize you're one of like four, right?
Yeah. No, I don't think I've – you hear about this all the time. Ah, why were the kids in the audience for this rated R show? No, you should not take your kids to see Deadpool. What are kids doing in the audience for 50 Shades Darker? You know, all that kind of stuff. And the only thing you could observe
is Guardians PG-13?
Yeah, and what I'm worried about is there's a scene where the space pirates are mean to baby Groot, and I think that could upset my little guy.
It's pretty scary. I saw it 2 days ago. It's scary.
Right. I mean, like just the, there's, you know, it's the thing is that it's not so much that many grown-up themes, and in fact some may argue it's got quite a few juvenile themes. But the idea of the both visual intensity and maybe emotional intensity.
It's like bullying. It's like a kid reliving being bullied in school, that one scene with little Groot. But it shouldn't let you stop your kids from going. You should just make sure you're taking care of them during that scene.
You got it exactly, Dave. That it's a lot of these things, I'm okay if I'm watching it with them and I can kind of, you know, talk them through it or if anything is bothering them or anything like that.
Or is this just an excuse for you to see the movie twice?
Oh, that's, you know, well, the problem is when I go and I see it and I don't like it and they still want to see it. That's, you know, like I wouldn't take them to see Batman versus Superman.
And how did you handle that?
They wanted to see it and I just waited for them to forget about it. Which didn't take that long because, and after a while, when they're old enough, we'll have the talk about Zack Snyder and his excessive use of slow motion. And how it felt like the entire movie was filmed in slow motion. And how in the DC movie universe, no one ever turns on the lights. When they talk about this is a dark world, I mean, literally, it's a dark world. No one actually turns on the lights in any of the sets.
That's right after this talk that both of them get hired at National Review, right?
No, there's no nepotism here.
Well, that leads me, I guess, kind of into the next thing I wanted to discuss, because the new trailer for Cars 3 is out, and that theoretically is a children's movie.
Yeah, except...
However, the themes that we're seeing coming out of it seem to be a little troubling.
It is. Now, from the first Cars movie, everybody's always said, oh, this is a cute, lovable Pixar idea. But it kind of has gone into some strange direction. This idea of like, okay, so how... So we have a world of cars in which cars are like people and cars drive around and stuff. But there's no people inside the cars, as far as we can tell. And they don't have hands. And so how do they do things? How do they, you know, like how where do they come from? Were there people once, and this is a future event? You know, people have kind of asked this, and this new one revolves around the main character, Lightning McQueen. Well, he's getting old, and there's some younger, better, with more high technology race car that's better than him. So Lightning McQueen is trying to improve himself, and so everybody's kind of left scratching their heads. Where do the cars come from? Does a mommy car and a daddy car get together and like make little baby cars? How you know, like, where does this all this stuff kind of work from? And it gets even worse because one of the first movies I took my younger guy to was Disney's awful spin-off Planes, which made actual references to World War II, including flashbacks of planes flying and dying in World War II.
So they can die.
They can die, but what's more, Mickey, Dave, you realize that the ramifications of this, at some point there was a little Volkswagen Hitler running around.
Okay, but my question is this. I get the idea of what I guess what I'm not getting from the trailers and from the articles written about the movie, and maybe it'll be more clear once we actually see it. But in Cars 3, there seems to be a kind of Rage Against the Machine going on. And I'm not 1,000% sure which way we're supposed to fall as the audience. Are we supposed to feel like Lightning McQueen is good enough, strong enough in his old school ways of, you know, kind of the Rocky running on the beach style training? Or is it the new car, the new technologically advanced car that we should all be adapting to?
No, you're absolutely right. This is the sort of thing where it makes a lot of sense when our protagonists age. It makes a little bit less sense when our protagonist is a car. And you kind of wonder, like, are kids going to relate to a storyline about getting older and not being as young as you used to be? Isn't this kind of, you know, this is very much a Star Trek style. This is the sort of thing that the theme that inevitably comes up in sequels. This sense of your protagonist getting older, they can't do what they used to do. All kinds of reasons that just, I'm not sure it really is going to fit.
I'm going to take you one further and say it's an animated car.
Yeah, it's a good point, right? I mean, like, you know, I
struggled with Cars 2, and I'm going to just be honest with the audience about this. I struggled with Cars 2. I did not find Cars 2 to be nearly as good as Cars 1. And again, we've talked about this before. You sometimes put these sequels out there simply because there's a market for the original. And oftentimes the sequels are not as good. They kind of miss the mark. And sometimes they completely miss the audience. Now, obviously, we're talking about Cars, but another big movie. I mean, Mr. Bias will tell you that his favorite movie is Aliens.
Okay. In his mind, did the series stop after two movies or after three?
He was fine with three. He owns the trilogy. Okay. But his favorite was the second one. Now, this is one of those rare occasions when you'll talk to people and they'll say, yes, the sequel was better than the original. Or you know what? They, you know, they
call me like crazy, but my favorite alien movie is the very last one, Predators, when they're on that. Oh, that's the wrong series. Pardon me.
Is that Predator versus Alien?
Yeah, that's where they crossed over in my mind. And once they crossed, they both became the same series. So now I think there's about eight of them.
Freddy versus Jason, so I'm okay with that.
For what they were, people really did like it. We've now kind of once you say, okay, we're putting two of the biggest, scariest monsters of science fiction up against each other, perfectly fine. I know that Sigourney Weaver loathes those movies and insists that they're not real or aren't part of the main series. We now have coming up this, I guess in a week or two, Alien Covenant, which is sort of a sequel to Prometheus, which was a kind of sort of hinted sequel or prequel to all the Aliens movies. Alien
Prometheus is on the do not watch list in this house.
Me too.
FYI.
Scary stuff.
Well, I was going to say, I believe it was the story of the dumbest scientist ever. constantly doing everything short of sticking their fingers in the alien's bumhole.
Boy, you suddenly got the attention of a whole new audience here, Jim.
Where is the alien's bumhole?
Long before the beloved crocodile hunter passed away, South Park made fun of him. And basically said, "Oh, this crocodile! I'm gonna stick my thumb up his bum hole and see what happens. he's really mad now." You know, the idea that Steve Irwin kept seeming to deliberately antagonize the crocodiles in an attempt to get more dramatic footage.
I'd have trouble finding that on an alien, though. That's exactly where is it? Where is it? You'd have to conduct
Prometheus
a search.
Really was a fantastic theme of, you know, let's see if we can get the audience to start rooting for the alien. That if you make your protagonist sufficiently dumb, you're like, okay. All right, just start eating these guys. Just start tearing them apart, you know, reproducing in their faces and stuff like that. So Covenant is coming, and the trailers, I suppose if you're an Alien fan, you'll love it. I'm looking at it, Mickey, and so far it looks like the same. It's the footage of Aliens from 1986, just with different actors.
Well, and therein lies part of the problem with this is I think that as some of these movies age, you're starting to get people wanting to produce, and specifically Sigourney Weaver's involved with this one in the production, is my understanding. And the idea that you want to kind of bring the story back to life, but bring it to life with the new technologies that are available to Hollywood and the producers and directors, et cetera, special effects. But if we already know the story and we love the story, and again, all of these movies that surround aliens, from Prometheus to, there were other movies that have come out, and sometimes you're watching them like, is this one of those aliens movies or no? Because they're just so close up against it. There was all those like Red Planet type things going on there for a while. And I just have to wonder if there is still the same kind of demand for that type of movie in the theater.
I still liked Alien versus Predator when they ran around in the little town like it was those sandworm movies with those B-grade actors and Reba McEntire.
Tremors.
That was a great movie.
The Alien versus Predator was a lot like that. A redneck
in
a small town.
In it? Because if Kevin Bacon is in it, then it makes it all better.
6 degrees of separation.
for obvious reasons, for budget and cost and scope and all that stuff, we very rarely spend much time on Earth in these movies. We very rarely see, the rest of society. It's always some sort of isolated mining colony or spaceship or space station. It's always a limited series of sets that can look really spooky with lots of steam coming out of places and dark crevices. And all of a sudden, blah, there's an alien. Blah, 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 blah. that's the advanced sound effects we have here.
That's fantastic.
Yes. Blah, 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 blah.
Speaking of budget, we can't afford to continue this segment any longer. So,
okay.
Oh, that's all the right, rap signal.
The only thing worse than getting caught on an alien planet is being a sports fan in D.C. And we'll discuss that right after this.
Balls of Fury.
Flight 209er clear for vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Our radio clearance over.
That's Clarence over.
Over. Roger.
Huh?
Roger, over.
Huh? It's kind of that middle area of the sports world where we've got all kinds of exciting things going on, listeners. We've got the NBA playoffs, the NHL playoffs, and of course, what am I focused on? Football. That's the most important thing to me. However, my Pens, who I, you know, I claim because they are part of the whole Pittsburgh franchise, have just defeated the Caps. And they're moving forward in their quest for the Stanley Cup playoffs. And this has left some DC sports fans wondering if they have been cursed.
Yeah, for a long time, you could say to point to Cleveland, right? The continuing travails and troubles of the Indians, who at least made it to the World Series last year. The Cleveland Browns having been terrible, and the Cavaliers before LeBron James. So for a long time, that was having, you know, rough town. Detroit, troubles for the Lions, troubles for the Tigers. So the Pistons were pretty darn good back in the late 80s, early 90s. There's a new discussion about whether Washington, D.C. now ranks as the most suffering city in the world of sports. I particularly enjoyed a column from the Washington Post's Thomas Boswell. And he finally gave this sense of gloom in the city a persona. He called it the Troll of Washington. And he had the idea
yes.
that he lives under the bridges, and he kind of whispers in the fans' ear, the Capitals are going to choke. The Wizards are never going to be any good. The Nationals will be great in the regular season and collapse in the playoffs. And there's a certain, you know, he writes this Tuesday morning. Big games for the Wizards against the Penguins, for the Wizards against the Celtics, and the Capitals against the Penguins, and the Capitals lose Game 7, and that's that. And the Wizards lost. They now are down 3-2 as of this taping against the Celtics. Celtics are very tough at home, and I think just about almost unbeaten, like 18-3 in Game 7 or something. So all of a sudden, the outlook for the Wizards is significantly gloomier. And we haven't even gotten started on the Redskins. And Mickey, you remember in the past, I've said Redskins fans are the most manic depressive in the NFL.
Oh, absolutely. I have never seen fans like them. I had not grown up around them. Once I moved here and met them, I didn't fully understand their psyche. Because as a Steelers fan, even when we're winning, my fear is that we're going to lose soon. And they're the opposite of that. In that if they win the first game of the season, good luck being around them.
Because they're already building the trophy case for the Lombardi Trophy.
Absolutely, every year.
And then, of course, once they lose it, Snyder is never going to let the team. You really want to put them on medication.
Yes, they are suffering fans, but they're also kind of self-inflicted suffering fans. Because what I have found with Redskins fans specifically is that a lot of times they are fans in the least accurate sense of the word. They don't always watch the games. They're not really all that invested in their team. But if they win, damn it, they are going to be all over you about it. And if they lose, the world could come to an end.
You know, because there's a lot of argument about what the great sports towns and sports cities are. I think, Pittsburgh would be high up there. I think most people concede, yes, Boston, as insufferable as they are, they are passionate and they stick by their teams through, good times and bad. They've had a lot of good times.
I think Pittsburgh, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, even to a certain degree.
Oh, absolutely. I would put in here, I will stand up as a New York, New York is a huge city, so it's always going to have a dedicated fan base. It's always going to have all that. So the question of who's worst, I think you can put almost any good warm weather town as one in which you're competing against going out and doing something fun, which is why the Florida Marlins never have anybody attendance and half the crowds at Jets
Jacksonville Dolphins. Jaguars too.
Right? Yeah. I mean, Jacksonville. Ugh. it's interesting to hear some people argue that the Montreal, the Canadiens and the former Expos and things like that, have their troubles, because you figure that with towns that have, or Portland with the Trailblazers, teams that have only one major professional sports team, you'd figure they'd be that there'd be a dedicated fan base. There's no competition, but apparently not. So I don't know. Any other spots you would continue to be the worst cities for sports with the worst fans?
Well, I mean, I kind of have to look at LA, because while they continue to get new teams, they can never keep them.
See, I would have guessed the infamous reputation of Philadelphia, whether it's booing Santa Claus, cheering the injury to Michael Irvin, all kinds of the jail inside the stadium.
They're the worst fans, but they are dedicated.
That's a good point. You got to bad behavior, but they're dedicated. But Mickey, you were telling me, you said there was some foreign fan base that may have even topped Philadelphia?
Yes, it appears that the people in Philadelphia may have a run for their money as it turns to the worst fans on the planet. And according to TMZ, There is a Denmark soccer team that was recently fined because they were throwing dead rats at the players on the field.
What?
According to TMZ, it all went down when the Brøndby IF football club was playing rivals FC Copenhagen on April 17th, and the Brøndby fans started throwing massive dead rodents on the opposing team.
You know how hard it is to sneak live rats into a stadium, don't you? I mean, they had to settle for dead ones.
I guess dead rats are better. I'm wondering, first of all, like, what is your thought process? Like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put dead rats in. I mean, I know that there is a hockey team that likes to throw squid.
No, it's the legend of the octopus for the Detroit Red Wings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they like to throw the squid onto the ice. However, when we're talking about dead rats, I want to know where they got them, how they got them into the stadium, and more importantly, who thought of this idea?
I'm going to go on a crazy limb and guess that alcohol was involved.
Were they drunk?
Hey, guys, we got to do the next.
Do it.
We'll throw rats at them. And if he scores 3 goals, we'll call it a rat trick and we'll throw 3 rats onto the field.
I'm not a soccer fan. However, I'm going to go ahead and link to this on our Facebook page because I really want our listeners to be able to see that these are not tiny mice we're talking about here either. These are full-fledged New York pizza rats. And they carried them in and tossed the dead ones on the field.
I want to go back. You mentioned the infamous octopus of the Detroit Red Wings. I almost want to salute them because apparently, I'm seeing here on Wikipedia, one 1995 game, fans threw 36 octopuses, including a specimen weighing 38 pounds. What do you have that slipped under your coat or something? No, it's just the 38-pound octopus I have under my coat.
I put on a little weight.
Go onto the ice after we score, you know?
But it does make you wonder, again, what they are checking at all of these security checkpoints. Oh, what is that? That's my dead rat.
It gets worse, right? So the Nashville Predators, now they don't have, no calamari is not going to do it for them. They began throwing catfish onto the home ice. Okay, so the first recorded incidents, and so they have a quote from a cleaning person, quote, they're so gross, they're huge, they're heavy, they stink. Because you're right, it's not like you're keeping your octopus or catfish in refrigeration during the first period or going to the game and stuff.
Why? They're throwing it on ice,
trail on the ice.
How could they do any better than icing it down, right? They're just trying to keep the smell down.
Where is PETA on all of this seafood abuse?
Wait, it gets worse. You know what they throw in San Jose? What's the team nickname?
Sharks.
The Sharks. Yes, 2007. Sharks fan threw a.
I want sharks with freaking laser beams on them.
How do you get a 3-foot leopard shark into the stadium?
This is where you start firing some security people. Like, okay, guys, a switchblade getting through security. Okay, some of these things we can understand. How do you sneak a 3-foot shark past security?
Did it have a freaking laser beam on its head?
Yeah. Boop. I'm gonna eat that later. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Well, one of the big stories out of sports this week is also the continued growth of the partnership between the NFL and Twitter. And while the NFL and Twitter have been working together the last couple years of trying to make Twitter kind of the official social media of the NFL, they announced today that they're going to actually be putting together a live show. It's going to be a live digital show that's going to air on Twitter 5 days a week during the NFL season. They're also going to have live pregame coverage where people can go on Twitter and watch it through the Periscope app. That Twitter has, and of course the NFL will continue to program highlights, breaking news, analysis. They do kind of a throwback Thursday for NFL sports, kind of, you know, historical trivia, things of that nature. One thing I noticed they're not going to be doing, Jim, is showing the game.
Yeah, I was about to say, so how much does any of that appeal to you?
It doesn't. As someone who loves football and loves the NFL, now I'm not suggesting that maybe, you know, they have not necessarily suggested who is going to be hosting these shows outside of the fact that it's going to be people from the NFL Network. My guess is that this is some way to supplement those who do not get the NFL Network through their cable package. And part of that continuing, like we've talked about on this show, the continuing, you know, they're not necessarily cutting the cord, but they're weaning it back.
See, I was about to say whether the fair question is when you want sports and you're a fan of your team. You know, I like to watch obviously the game. If I had enough discretionary time, I might watch the pregame show. And I think I preferred the ESPN one the most because it was the least, you know. Linebacker Johnny Jones has a strange habit, you know, hobby in the off season. He likes to raise ducks or something, you know, instead of like, no, here's who's going to win, here's the X's and O's, all that kind of stuff. Mickey, are you eager to watch the pregame stretching through Periscope? Right? What exactly am I going to see through this that that's going to change my understanding and appreciation of the game?
I will be completely honest. If they focus on the Steelers, I will probably end up watching some of it. And again, it'll depend on who the hosts are and what they do with it. But as you mentioned just now, you said, you know, how would you feel about the pregame stretching? And all I could envision were my people in the black and gold and thinking, I'll watch that.
Okay. I guess an interesting question, maybe something that, you know, the ESPNs of the world having their recent financial troubles and layoffs would want to ask the question. So what do our fans actually want in this, right? Like, deep down, I want to hear somebody saying, yeah, the Jets have a chance of winning this game. And I keep clicking around looking for an analyst who would say that. And then if so, what they have to do, what to expect, and that kind of stuff. I don't know if watching the pregame warmups gives me that much, you know. But maybe I'm turning into a cranky sports fan.
I think what we're going to end up seeing is it just kind of expand on what we already see as the sideline reporter. You know, they always flash to the sideline reporter who gives, you know, a 30-second analysis of nothing.
He's holding his hamstring. Back to you guys.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see the rise of the sideline reporter kind of come up through some of this live programming. So it might be interesting to see how it plays out. What I do think is the most interesting about it is the way that they're expanding beyond cable at this point and trying to reach out to social media. I do find it fascinating they chose to go through Twitter and not through Facebook, though.
Well, you know, it's only your grandmother who's on Facebook anymore. So we will be looking at this. Maybe people have decided that Facebook has gotten too politically correct with Zuckerberg or something. But we'll be looking at political correctness and a surprising new target of their outrage right after this.
Hey, here's a great place to visit if you must do some driving. Your independent Texaco retailer. Ask how he can help you get better mileage with quality Texaco products.
Chocolate lovers, watch out for new Choco Bliss.
Oh, what a sweet sensation.
Welcome back to the Jim and Mickey Show. I am Jim Garrity, joined by Mickey White, who I understand did an appearance on Christian Toto's program recently. Am I right, Mickey?
Yes, I did. I was on Hollywood and Toto, the podcast, a few weeks ago, and we talked a little bit about this show and also some of the writings that I do, and I got to plug my Kardashian love as well.
Yeah. Well, you might have figured he has a good item and he kind of collects a bunch of reviews of this new movie featuring is Amy Schumer still one of your favorites, Mickey?
She was never one of my favorites.
Wasn't? Okay. All right, maybe I'm misremembering that. Okay.
The truth of the matter is when I watched her original comedy Central show, I thought that it had potential. It was actually quite funny. I did not hate Trainwreck. But after that, things went really south really quickly with me and her.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, she became a one of the most outspoken, politically active celebrity figures, and obviously a great son of people. She's got a new movie coming out with Goldie Hawn, a mother-daughter adventure.
Snatched.
Snatched, yes. Which, boy, oh boy, getting torn apart by the critics. And one of the interesting things is the idea that it's being criticized for not being politically correct. Quoting the New York Times review, it says, you know, Snatched is one of those movies that subscribes to the dubious homeopathic theory of cultural insensitivity by which the acknowledgement of offensiveness is supposed to prevent anyone from taking offense. The idea is that if you use variations of the phrase, that's racist, as a punchline a few times, nothing else you say or do could possibly be racist, including, say, populating your movie with dark-skinned thugs with funny accents and killing a few of them for cheap laughs. Now, look, I haven't seen the movie. I can't evaluate it. I suppose I could take a certain amount of pleasure at Amy Schumer being denounced for not being politically correct enough. I guess the – even here, though, Mickey, I don't know about you, I find myself – my teeth grinding a bit because – you kind of have to leave artists free to make mistakes. Like, even if it turns out bad, I kind of want to encourage the risk-taking, even if it might offend somebody.
Okay, I want to just clarify that I have no desire to see this movie as it looks terrible. Okay. I also am just disgusted with the fact that they brought Goldie Hawn back to do a buddy girl movie, and she was not cast with Kate Hudson, her daughter.
Yeah, right? I mean, the only explanation I can think of is the common widespread rumor that Kate Hudson is actually a clone of Goldie Hawn.
Well, it appears that Amy Schumer had her hands all over this particular project. And in fact, you know, part of the writing, part of the producing, and part of bringing Goldie Hawn into it. Well, Goldie Hawn is a comedic legend and her timing is impeccable. But the idea of her being paired up with someone as clumsy as Amy Schumer and as awkward. And I say this in the way that she actually delivers her lines and the way that she quote unquote acts. And you guys can't see me right now, but I'm using air quotes around acts, because nothing that I've really seen Amy Schumer do is something that's much of a stretch beyond the characters and the stand-up that she's done.
Yeah, it's the same persona in role to role.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, she was recently booted from a Barbie project, which I supported wholeheartedly because I thought whatever the Barbie project was going to be, it was going to be 10 times worse if she was involved.
Yeah, I get, like, you know, the idea of how you're going to build an entire movie around Barbie. Granted, I'm not the target demographic, but
Barbie has tons of movies, by the way, like tons of movies for little girls that are
animated
about
animated movie, yeah,
you know. Things like that, et cetera. This, yes, a live action Barbie movie is probably going to happen. It does make me feel better that Amy Schumer won't be involved because she's a little bit of toxic for brands.
Thick in the middle, if you'll pardon my Barbie joke.
Well, apparently the idea was she was the imperfect Barbie. I'm like, yes, but was she like the nasty, nobody wants to hang out with her Barbie?
They'd have never let her off the assembly line. She's too imperfect.
And I think about what, you know, again, I think about what she did with Bud Light and what she does with Old Navy. And unfortunately, she's kind of a product of her own creation in the sense that she made herself famous by being an offensive, you know, sexually charged comic who says crazy things that you wouldn't quote unquote expect a girl to say, then goes out and tries to brand herself with this. And brands seem to have missed the mark on the idea that she kind of comes off as the girl that is doing the walk of shame the next day. Mm. And, you know, she is kind of like the, and not the good bad girl, more like the bad girl where you go, oh.
So this is like wearing a black dress and carrying your heels and walking in pantyhose down a busy residential sidewalk at like 8 in the morning, right?
Yes, with their mascara smeared off the side of her
face. Okay, I got you.
And again, I'm not judging. I'm just saying that's kind of how she comes across.
You are correct. I would point out that we have seen some phenomenal flips in people in actors, performers, personas. Let's do a time machine, Mickey. Let's go back to the late 80s, early 90s, and let everyone know that Ice-T, author of Cop Killer, will spend about a decade playing a cop on television in various Dick Wolf TV shows. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Or that Ice Cube will someday be making family comedies.
Yeah, Ice-T,
Are we there yet?
All the boys that come out of Compton have the ability to be flexible and malleable, apparently, depending on the role. But the thing about it is these guys were very bright and very smart going into their careers. And while certainly, you know, gangster rap was how they got started, if you look into their backgrounds a little bit more and you look into them as people, you'll find that they were very driven individuals. They were going to be successful in whatever avenue they chose to go into. With Schumer, it's a little bit different because once she started to just get that peak of fame, she then also attached herself to her uncle, Chuck Schumer, and attached herself to a lot of very liberal-leaning causes. And then tried to kind of come back around and say, no, I'm still the funny anti-PC girl. Because if you watch her original Comedy Central show, this is the type of show that will cause anyone who has that, oh, we need to have a certain civility in our society.
Yeah.
They would be shocked by some of the things that she put forth. But that was what I found funny. Again, I'm a South Park Republican in the sense that I like things that are funny and offensive at times because I think that there's a place for that.
Yeah, her mistake is she's going to half the country that doesn't want to hear it and stopping with the comedy in the middle of the show to do ugly, plain, hard left politics without humor. And she's got people walking out of her shows. I heard about one in Tampa where, you know, about a third of the people got up and left because they were so mad. It wasn't what they paid to come to see.
Absolutely. And it's a balancing act when you're in this position and you are someone, again, she did not really have a solid footing in Hollywood before she started trekking down this path of, I'm going to tell people how they should think and how they should live, and without giving a great deal of thought to what her actual personal brand was. Mm-hmm. Because her personal brand is, I'm a drunk and a slut.
Yeah, yeah. My sneaking suspicion is that Snatched will not do well, and everyone will have a ready-made reason. The New York Times reviewer may look at it and say, well, it's a terrible movie because it's so politically incorrect. It makes racist jokes and then tries to excuse itself by denouncing those jokes as racist, et cetera, et cetera. Some people might say, oh, this is Amy Schumer. She's become very publicly left-wing. Hooray for her movie, you know, Crashing and Burning. I think if Snatched is going to rise or fall, I'd like to see Snatched rise or fall on its own merits, which is to say, you know, it looks terrible. So maybe it's a really terrible movie. But I almost want to say I'd rather be in a I'm more worried about performers not making good ideas for film for the fear it might offend someone than I am about somebody actually being offended by a movie. Because if it looks bad, you just don't go and see it.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I am for all for free speech and free expression. And I think that, again, the problem that she got into is trying to walk that line, not realizing that she would be harming herself in the long term. That when these people do turn on you, and they will, the PC police, the SJWs, whatever you want to call them, it's very difficult to make a comedy where you're not being offensive, because good comedy often is offensive.
Yeah, you really can't, it's very hard to be the politically correct shock jock. And it's interesting. I remember Howard Stern has run into this in recent years, an argument that he's gone soft. He's much more open about aligning himself with certain perspectives that are seen as mainstream in Hollywood. And he was, unbelievably crass and unbelievably.
But this is a guy. We're on Howard Stern. This is a guy who made his entire living and fortune talking about lesbians and boobs.
Right, I guess one of the things that might be particularly unnerving to people is that if political correctness can, I'm making air quotes as I say this, can civilize Howard Stern, right? If Howard Stern reaches a point where he doesn't want to cross the boundaries of taste for fear of running afoul of this crowd, right? Who's left, right? It's the South Park guys, and then not too many folks beyond that. And that's
thank
kind
God
of
for South Park.
I'm sorry, what?
I said thank God for South Park, because they are some of the few people out there that are still putting out fresh and entertaining comedy, and they attack everyone equally, and I'm okay with that. I think, again, what does kind of keep them away from it is they address it within their material, within their product. They are not addressing it in side speeches, in letters to the editor, in announcements with Chuck Schumer standing by them.
Yeah. Again, most of these, like, the other thing is that, look, I mean, Hollywood churns out so many given movies in a year. That's not even counting direct-to-video. That's not even counting made-for-cable movies. That's not even counting, that I would hate to think that everybody started catering to the same audience and being afraid of certain new taboos being imposed, and everybody trying to be afraid of, don't address that. You'll offend somebody or something like that. There's already enough groupthink going on in Hollywood. We just talked about the sequels and stuff. And eventually you end up with a entertainment landscape where everything starts to look the same. Maybe kind of like primetime network television.
Now that's a perfect segue. We will take a look at those after this.
Tastes like a beer, because it should, because it's brewed like a beer. Of course it's good.
Working out or working late, when you're thirsting for a break, let's be perfectly clear. It's what beer drinkers drink when they're not drinking beer. O'Doul's.
O'Doul's, the brew from Anheuser-Busch, with the alcohol naturally removed for real beer taste and only 70 calories.
Anytime, anywhere, it's what beer drinkers drink when they're not drinking beer. O'Doul's.
Welcome back to the Jim and Mickey Show. I am Mickey White along with Jim Garrity, and we are talking about the time of year that it is right now where people find out that their favorite shows will not be coming back in the fall. This is when the networks announce their upfronts for the new shows, and they also let people know the shows that they have decided to cancel. Some of these are being canceled after just one season, and some are being canceled after several very successful seasons.
Yeah, I know. I went down the list. I didn't see any shows that I watch or feel particularly attached to, so I'm not that. So I an interesting bit of a development, Scandal, the ABC show that turned Kerry Washington into a star, is, you know, the upcoming season is the seventh season.
Yes.
But that's going to be the last. So it's not canceled per se, as in psh, that's it. It's that, no, this is, you know, we got one last one, wrapping it up. And that's one that seems genuinely surprising. Although I look at that, I wonder whether Kerry Washington wants to do movies or something.
I think that that's a possibility. But I also think that, you know, when you look around to when Scandal was originally announced, when it came out, some of these political dramas may not fly well in the current atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. No, first of all, as I'm reading the description, one of the writers had to scrap a planned storyline that featured Russians hacking the presidential election.
Right.
Reality struck a little too close for home. There were a couple things about Scandal that I've never been a regular watcher of the show and not particularly big fan. But I was going to observe one, like, it's politics for people who have no interest in politics whatsoever.
Yes.
So people would ask me, oh, you know, like when my occasional interactions with people who don't follow U.S., you know, actual real world politics at all, they will ask me, well, don't you think it could be? And they come up with the most insanely outlandish conspiracy theories. And I'd say, yeah, no, that really can't happen. Or, you know, actually, that would be, you know, that would be breaking the Constitution. Or, no, I'm fairly certain the president doesn't have a secret assassination squad. Or, no, I'm fairly certain the vice president has not been kidnapped. You know, things where the producers of 24 would say, okay, that's a little far-fetched.
Right. And I think that the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that you're looking at a scenario where we've had a great deal of political dramas. And right now we've got House of Cards on Netflix, which, in my opinion, is probably the best political drama that's ever been put together. And it's still going strong, but at the same time, it's a much more measured storytelling format within the Netflix world. Whereas, you know, one of the big lines for all of these broadcast shows when they're doing something that they feel is real to life, they like to say what, Jim? It's been ripped from the headlines.
Yeah.
And put into the story. And nobody really wants to watch it on TV.
When Dick Wolf decides to make Paula Deen kill Trayvon Martin. yeah, I suppose you could say that's ripped from the headlines, as in both of those figures were in the news. But, you know, it's basically Dick Wolf's, here's how it should have happened, which is how you end all these billionaire serial killers and angry anti-government militias operating out of Staten Island.
What I find interesting about the list is there was a big sweep in over the last 2 years of time travel shows. And as someone who was a big fan of Quantum Leap, I initially looked into a lot of these shows, and almost all of them are being canceled this year.
Yeah, and you know,
time after time, and it makes me wonder, why was it the storylines that weren't solid? Was it the acting that wasn't solid? Or are we just over the point of seeing people flip back and forth between time?
A lot of these, from where I'm sitting, seemed kind of generic. Oh, you know, what if Jack the Ripper came to today? Well, then we'd have a remake of Silence of the Lambs. You know, Timeless or whatever, the one that had them going back in time seemed somewhat interesting, but you kind of knew that each story episode was going to end with the main timeline of regular history being fixed, and you would not end up with the Soviets winning the Cold War or something like that. What I thought would be a much more interesting concept for a show is the idea of, it's a time traveler who's come back trying to change the future, but the future is very dystopian. And what they're actually doing is changing the timeline from disastrous things happening to the way things turned out, i.e. they're trying to prevent Lincoln from being assassinated in the first year of the first year of the Civil War. And the idea is that reality that we're all living in is the alternate timeline. This is the better world that they're trying to build. And so the idea is not watching history go wrong, villains trying to make the history go wrong, and heroes trying to stop them.
All the screenwriters in the audience right now are just writing notes.
Go with it, because I'm not going to have time to develop this idea. But the gist being that instead of watching our hero succeeds, right? Our hero succeeds in changing time to make it more like this, and that what we're all living in, as frustrating and depressing as it may seem, is the good scenario, because other scenarios of history could have gone much worse.
Let me throw this to you. Is there a problem with us doing these kind of time travel stories now? Because we are implementing and enforcing the rules of this time period into those characters.
Oh, I think that's, yeah, there's inevitably a bit of awkwardness. On one of the time travel shows, they had an African-American one. And obviously, this, on the one hand, this gives you an opportunity to do a lot of good stories about America's history, our race relations, what it would be like to live under segregation. But on the other hand, it also means that this person is going to have a very difficult time sneaking around and infiltrating things and doing all the things that their mission is going to require them to do. So that always struck me as bad. You know, it's interesting looking at all this extraordinarily long list of cancellations, Mickey. Do you know it's still going to be around?
What's that, Jim?
NCIS.
NCIS and cockroaches.
NCIS, the never canceled investigative service.
Mark Harmon in a wheelchair.
And I, you know, there are years I've enjoyed it. I really think the show lost something with the departure of Ziva.
Yeah.
I really think the show lost even more with the departure of Michael Weatherby, who went off to do Bull, and now they don't have Donoso. I'm extremely disappointed that they brought on Wilbur Valderrama. I'm mangling his name. But they haven't done a single Can We Build It? Yes, We Can. Handy Manny joke at any point in the show.
I need to tell you, my problem with NCIS as someone who lives in the state of Virginia has been from the beginning, and I got hooked on NCIS during the Ziva years, and I stopped watching promptly after she left. That was pretty much the last time I watched NCIS. I didn't even wait around for Michael Weatherby to leave. Ziva was it for me, and once she was gone, so was the show. However, my biggest problem has and will continue to be that they make people in the rest of the, whatever, 49 states believe that you can get from D.C. to Norfolk and back in an afternoon and then usually like an hour and a half.
Yes.
It's almost like, I'm going to take a half-hour trip down to Norfolk. Oh, okay.
Yeah, also, you pass through the deserts and mountains of northern Virginia along the way.
There's always a cabin just outside Richmond. Like, yeah. Richmond's not a city. Like, it's like it blows my mind how many times I have watched this. Oh, he's staying in a cabin outside Richmond. Where? Where are their cabins? I'd like to know where this is.
Egregious misuse of a location since Jack Power got in a terrible gunfight at the massive seaport in Alexandria, Virginia. All the cargo container ships that park in Alexandria.
And the thing about it is it makes me wonder, when people write these shows, I realize, you know, a lot of it has to be written in for the fictionalization of everything, but legitimately, do they not know about our traffic problems here?
A better, more creative team could build an entire sequence out of attempting to have a car chase in the middle of like beltway traffic.
Oh, absolutely. Hour, right? I want to see them get from, you know, one part of D.C. to another in a half hour, let alone all the way down to Norfolk Naval Base and back up.
No, the NCIS, look, it's very rarely a bad episode. I still watch it with Mrs. Campaign Spot. And I haven't really grown terribly attached to any of the new characters. The chemistry isn't quite there. There's now a little bit of murmurs that Gibbs could end up becoming the new director. It doesn't really fit his character, but the idea that maybe he wants to take a back seat in future episodes.
I just rolled my eyes.
It just kind of plods along.
Reminds me of another CBS show that seemingly never goes away and has had some really horrible seasons, and that's Criminal Minds.
Oof.
And I still watch Criminal Minds every single week, and that's my fault. By the way, it's on me for still watching. But slowly but surely, they have taken away characters. They've taken away plots. They've created whole scenarios around Spencer Reed that don't even make sense. The poor boy has had heroin addiction. His girlfriend was killed before he ever even had a chance to kiss her. And this season, they threw him in jail.
I used to love Mandy Patinkin, but he's turned into one of the guys most difficult to work with and most critical and most odd duck, you know, actor. And I can't stand watching him in the show because it makes me think about what he's like in person.
Well, and he was fantastic as Jason Gideon. And I will be honest with you, I was happy when they brought in Tony Montana as well to replace him.
Joe Montana. Yeah, he was excellent.
Tony, excellent. Joe, yes.
Say hello to his little friend.
I knew it didn't sound right. But I love him, and I love the Rossi character, and I was willing to work with them on that. But they have played musical characters with us for a long time. Like, oh, JJ's not here anymore, but here's another little blonde. And when they got rid of Shamar Moore, they suddenly brought in, you know, a Latin actor. Now they've brought in a black actor. Neither of them are as hot as Shamar Moore. So they're not really meeting the quota that he delivered for me.
I believe the final episode of the series did feature the team targeting the mastermind behind all the terrible crimes that they've seen perpetuated year by year. They finally went after the Criminal Minds writing staff and hunted them down and caught them on a Hollywood studio. And
well, that's pure evil.
And wrapped them all up.
So. Well, what I started watching that show for was because they were tracking serial killers. Like, you know, one is kind of like NCIS and other of the procedurals where you could theoretically watch one episode out of the chain or out of the series and you'd still know what was going on. And what they started doing was building these larger story arcs with all of this personal thing involving the team of the BAU. And I don't care. I just want them to catch killers. That's it.
Well, maybe that's let's admit catching killers is a tough job, but probably not as tough a job as you've had. We'll be talking about our listeners' toughest jobs right after this.
Paging Mr. Herman. Mr. Herman, you have a telephone call at the front desk.
Sunday night, 2,000 pounds of raging terror stalking its prey by night.
Welcome back to the Jim and Mickey Show. I am Jim Garrity, joined by Mickey White. And Mickey, I think we'd both agree, to the extent this is a job, and I'm making air quotes as I say that, it's one of our easiest and most enjoyable. But lots of us have had bad and tough jobs. And you asked all of our listeners this week on Trivial Tuesday what the worst job, and saying, pointing out that sometimes the worst job is your first job. I feel particularly bad for Durf, a.k.a. Fred on Twitter, spelled Twitter with a U.
Yes.
Worst job for him was working at a turkey leg stand at Six Flags. That strikes me because he lasted one day. I know that feeling.
Turkey leg.
Well, and I asked him, you know, were turkey legs, you know, is it a hard sell? What was the situation?
It's not like he's at a medieval festival or anything.
Yes, and he said, you know, obviously being in the park and on the hot asphalt, on top of that, he also was cleaning out grease drains.
Yes, I refuse to clean out a grease trap ever again. And that sounds pretty darn unpleasant. I can understand that. But who knows? He could have had a brilliant career in turkey leg sales.
You never know. Jim, did you ever have a really bad job?
For sheer manual labor and heat and unpleasantness, Baxter Healthcare, medical supply warehouse for a summer. Not pleasant, you know, loading trucks all day and working. I believe the day started at 4 p.m. and a lot of days would go to 4 a.m. Working 50, 60 hours a week and, you know, not great. But there are worse jobs, no doubt. First jobs was a Food Town supermarket checkout job. And, man, was I, you know, I got one day of training, which was nowhere near enough to operate the cash register. And then was thrown to the wolves. There are people in the service telling me to quit whining right now. So
I worked at a driving range when I was a kid, a golf driving range. And the tractor that we used to pull the pickup trailer for the golf balls was a 1947 Willys Jeep, a military surplus, and the cage built on it to protect the driver was only on one side. The pro never bothered to finish building the cage, so every time I made a left turn on the driving range, I faced the range without a cage, and my buddies were always there hitting golf balls at me. I can't tell you how many times I caught golf balls in the ribs and on the forearm, and guys trying to bang golf balls at me from 120 yards away with the driver because I was unprotected. It's like, hey! I'd only lasted one summer.
I'm sure they were aiming for you, Dave.
They were. I know I did when the other guy was up.
Well, I mentioned my brief foray into the restaurant service whenever I worked for an ice cream shop in my small hometown, and I worked there for a total of 4.5 hours. Cam Edwards actually kind of fell in line with me there. He said his worst job was working for Hardee's years ago, and I knew then I was not cut out for food service, but they were making me, as I would make the ice cream cones, I'd have to weigh each one individually, and if they didn't weigh the exact amount, they wanted me to dump it back in and start over. So yeah. I didn't last long there. And I have worked in warehouses. I also sold Kirby's when I was in college, which was a totally different experience. I was certainly not what they expected whenever they had the person coming to, quote, clean their carpet for free. And I would show up and show my Kirby and sell it. And I not only loved the product, I own one. So there you go. Sold myself.
Looking over the list here, I feel particular sympathy for Heather, who says her first job was calling people to tell them that if they did not pay their electric bill, their power would be discontinued. And I saw you'd ask, was it hard? Obviously, but she says, when she had to call people she went to church with, and she pointed out that she had to give her full name to follow, you know, regulations and things like that. How, you know, maybe you could do that with sympathy, but in the end, you're basically saying, yeah, you know, if you
get it done. And we had another listener that apparently his job was to repossess televisions.
Oh.
And he said it was horrible because he would show up and, of course, the kids would be crying and there were fights and whatnot. And his job was basically to get that television out of the house. One of our listeners, and unfortunately I don't have it up in front of me right this second. One of our listeners, their first job was actually cleaning out stables.
Oh.
And I was fascinated by how many of our listeners and so many people that participated in the Twitter game with us this week started out making less than $2 an hour.
Was this tips positions or just back in the, you know?
I think it was back in the day. One of our listeners was even paid to be a test student so that teachers could practice on them.
Interesting. Yeah, I suppose that actually, in a way, that could be challenging because you're trying to look at things through the eyes of the average student, right? So you're trying, you know, if you get it too well, you're not doing a good job. But if you're also particularly stupid, you can't do the job particularly well either.
Absolutely. And one of the things I want to share with our listeners this week is totally by coincidence, Forbes has also released America's Best Employees, the 2017 ranking. And number one on the list for the very first time is Costco. And they have knocked Google to number two. And we all know all the cool things that people at Google get to do, right? So Costco must be doing something right.
I wouldn't doubt that. Look, it is interesting. The other interesting thing, we talked about this last week as a possible Trivia Tuesday. I noticed people talk about how much they hated the jobs, but they almost talk about it with a certain fondness, right? Like they're all glad that they did them. They're also glad to be rid of them. But they kind of feel like that it's some – like everybody has a really rough either first job or second job or early employment. Nobody starts out in the corner executive suite. No, you know, really or very few people do and things like that. Like having a – you can learn a lot both about yourself and how the world works from a really bad job. So, you know, if everybody just got used to the idea that you're going to have a bad job for about at least a year in your life or a couple months and just deal with it, I think the world would be a better place.
And kind of take the experience that comes along with that. And I think you're absolutely right. People look fondly back on these jobs, one, because they did them, and two, because they don't have to do them anymore.
Hey, I got to hit free golf balls at the driving range as part of my super low pay package, and it ended up helping me walk on to my college golf team and make the team. So I became a collegiate athlete and a very good golfer because people hit golf balls at me like a target all day.
Well, see, there you go, Jay. You got
summer.
A lot from that
That's
experience,
right.
Although part of me kind of wants to see video.
I wish I'd had it back then. I wish I'd had it.
I'm just letting you know. And, oh, my goodness, guys, we are at the end of another hour. It goes by so quickly because I do enjoy my time with you all so very much. But we are wrapping up here. So you can find this and every single episode at soundcloud.com/Jim and Mickey Show. Do look us up on Facebook.com/Jim and Mickey Show. Give us a like, hang out there, talk to us, see some of the articles that we post along with the episodes. And, of course, you can always find us on Twitter at Jim and Mickey. And you can find Jim at Jim Garrity, and I'm at Bias Girl. We are here every week with Big Dave Perkins, and you can find him at Big Dave P. I'm Mickey White. He's Jim Garrity, and you've been listening to the one and only Jim and Mickey Show.
Straight down the middle, it went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee bit, and that's when my caddy lost sight of it. That little white pellet has never been found to this day, but it went straight down the middle, like they say. Whack down the fairway,
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way. The sun was never brighter, the greens were...